Okay, it's 2 o'clock. They're counting down on me. Thank you for coming to this workshop, Song of Songs, Love, Marriage, and the Application of the Grace of God. My name is Steve Thurman. I know you are tired. I know it's the afternoon. I know you have eaten, and I know you're ready to take a nap. I always like this one right here. It's about what you feel like doing. And how many of you read the cartoon strips in the newspaper? Do you like them? I read Pickles. Here's my favorite one. Can you read that?
No.
How come you sleep in the daytime, Grandpa? I don't sleep. I just take lots of very short cat naps. How short are your cat naps? I just had one while you were talking. I'll show you a bunch of these as we poke along through this session together. I have quite a few. It's a great cartoon strip for married couples, especially if you're an older married couple. If you're a younger married couple, you'll end up being like this one day. So don't be cocky about it. Don't go, I'll never act like that. Yeah, you will. You will, I promise. Now, I first preached a Song of Songs about 35 years ago when I was pastoring at Fellowship Bible Church of Colorado Springs. And I knew then, as I know now, that this is a beautiful picture of relational grace, whether it's in the dating relationship or in the marriage relationship, premaritally or maritally, of a man and a woman deeply, deeply in love. In his book, The Four Loves, C.S. Lewis wrote this: falling in love, in one high bound, it has overleaped the massive wall of selfhood. It has tossed personal happiness aside as a triviality and planted the interest of another in the center of our being. I always like that because it's just true. When you are in love, when you love your husband, you love your wife, all of a sudden, you don't really seem to matter too much to yourself. Their happiness, their pleasure, their hope, their joy becomes the center of your life. I know that you'll hear a lot about my wife in this. And she's not perfect. I don't want you to come away from this thinking she's perfect, but she is probably the most, I mean, I live with her every day, so I see every side of her, and I think she's probably, or is the greatest person I've ever known. She's just incredible, but I spend my day, and I know she spends her day, what will make my wife happy? What will touch her heart? What will encourage her? And you know you're really in love when that becomes the beginning of each day and the thought of each day. In other words, when we are in love, that other person completely and totally captivates our very being. Everybody agree with that? You know that, don't you? At the same time, two people in love happen to be sinners saved by grace. Two people who bring to their relationship their depraved and their deprived natures and their insecurities and their own likes and dislikes, their personal opinions about this and that. And so one day can go one way and another day can go another. Marriage is hard work. Or should I say, a good and godly marriage requires hard work and submission to God. Marriage is no cakewalk. You can never, ever let up. That's my opinion anyway. I certainly try to never let up, and I know my sweet, precious wife never lets up on our marriage. I will stay positive, and so I won't dwell on the glum and gloomy Christian marriages among our Christian friends. We see a lot of glum and gloomy Christian marriages in our lives. It just breaks our heart. I know I sent something out many years ago, and I said, send me a picture that just without words describes your marriage. Now, some marriages most marriages, I hope, happen to be like this one. This one's mine. This is what I wake up to every morning. Unless she's deathly ill, which is never, I wake up to a smile every single morning of my life. And this is our day. And we miss each other when we're apart, and it's just a time of a unique pleasure at this time in our life. Now, some marriages, one guy sent me this. This is his marriage. Now, this is a real woman, and she was a prohibitionist, and that's her Bible, and that's her hatchet. And she would go in, and she'd take that hatchet, and she would hack some of the bars apart. And she's quite, you can read about her, and I thought, well, okay, my wife has standards, biblical standards, but she doesn't act like that or look like that or carry a hatchet around the house. And I'm glad I'm not married to that woman. And then a woman sent me this. This was her marriage. I know. Does that just tick you off or what? And she said, okay, I don't need to put any words to this. This is my marriage right here. I taught a women in ministry course in Nepal about 3 years ago. It's a master's course. I teach these master's courses for a Christian organization around the world, and it was on women in ministry. And this is the marriages that the women describe in Nepal, and they're all just hurt, and they're angry, and they're bitter. And so I had to work my way through that. In some marriages, there's no communication. There's little or no laughter, appreciation, or joy, little or no intimacy, affection, or tenderness. I have a very close friend that lives not far from here. In fact, I married him and his wife many years ago, a Christian couple, and he said, we are simply now, after these decades, two people living together more like roommates, just getting along. Now, that breaks your heart. But you all are Christians, you attend churches, you have a million friends, and you know what I'm saying is true. You see a lot of marriages that are just like this, and it breaks your heart. But enough of that. I'm going to be positive. Now, does everybody have an outline, that piece of paper? You need that. I want to say some things. Let me begin by giving a brief survey of the song. First, this is a story often called the Song of Songs. Now, we know from 1 Kings chapter 4, verse 32, that Solomon wrote over 1,005 songs, and this undoubtedly is the best and the greatest. It's often called the Song of Solomon, but from the Hebrew text, we get the Song of Songs, which comes from chapter 1, verse 1. So this is one of his many songs. It's the longest, I guess. It's the one we have recorded that is just, to me, it is incredibly unique. Now, that's the second thing I want you to know. It's unique in all the Bible. It has some unique biblical characteristics. First, it is perennially one of the most misunderstood books in all the Scripture. We don't have time to get into that at all. And so I won't take any time, but it is highly misunderstood. Second, it is the only book where the love between a man and a woman is the primary plot and theme, which I think is tremendously special that God would include it. And third, there is in this book no reference to God whatsoever. That's amazing to me. Now, some say, if you want to look at some point at chapter 8, verse 6, that somehow is a reference to God. I don't personally see it, but some tried to pull God out of that verse. But I don't see any reference to the Lord at all in this book. Of course, He is behind the scene in everything that's taking place. Fourth, there is in this book no direct reference to sin. Now, you see the consequences of sin in this book as they relate to one another and as they struggle. And you see sin act itself out in some ways, but there's no real direct reference to sin. Now, third, the purpose of this song, I'm trying to get to the application of grace, so this is just a brief survey, but the purpose of this song, again, this is where many disagree and why it's such a misunderstood book, but as I see it, it's simple. It is to give us a picture of love and romance as it is to be. Okay? Not as it later, people always ask me, well, what about Solomon and all his wives? Well, my opinion, that's later. Solomon messes up later in his life. This is early on, and this is how it should be in a relationship. It is to honor human love, relationships, and marriage in a way that honors the Lord and the purity of the marriage relationship. Now, fourth, there are three main characters in our song. I think people disagree about this, but I see three main characters. First, there is Solomon. He is, as you know, the king of Israel. He is the son of David and Bathsheba. Then there is the maiden. Now, she's the beloved fiance. And then the bride of Solomon. And then you have this group that are called the daughters of Jerusalem. Well, who are they? Well, I'm guessing, and many take it this way, they are a background chorus, or they are just a group of friends or attendants who may be companions of the bride or attendants to the king or interested onlookers or simply thoughts and reflections personified poetically. No one really knows these things for sure, but they are in the text. So you have Solomon, the maiden, and you have the daughter of Jerusalem. Now, fifth, you have the setting I want to talk about. And the setting of this song is, and I'm including information from the entire song, about 50 miles north of Jerusalem, Solomon owned a vineyard in the hill country of Ephraim, a vineyard that he let out or rented out to a family. And this family consisted of a mother and her two sons and her daughters. And one of these daughters was the Cinderella of the family. She was naturally beautiful, but she was dealt with firmly by her brothers. Why? I don't really know why, but we get that from the text, as I think you'll see in a moment. She was a young woman who worked hard in the fields. She pruned the vines. You can imagine what that did to her hands. She tended the soil. You can imagine what that did to her fingernails. She set the traps for the foxes in the fields all day under the sun. Her clothes were farming clothes. They were work clothes. Her fingernails were probably broken and dirty. If you turn in your Bibles, if you want to, or I could lead you along here, in the Song of Songs, chapter 1, verse 5, 6, we get a bit more about this maiden. Listen in her own words. I am dark but lovely, O daughters of Jerusalem, like the tents of Kedar, like the curtains of Solomon. Do not look upon me. Don't look upon me because I'm dark, because the sun has tanned me. My mother's sons, my brothers, were angry with me. They made me the keeper of the vineyards, but my own vineyard, she's speaking of herself, her physical self, I have not kept, or I've not been able to keep. Okay? Now, today, dark suntanned skin may be a sign of wealth and leisure and beauty, but definitely not so in her world. And that's not how it would have been seen. She is dark in a fair-skinned society. She is sunburnt, which is a sign of the common class of a worker in the fields. I take it that she may even be, if not embarrassed, a little bit insecure about herself as she relates to this bigger world outside her farm. "Do not look at me," she says. "I am dark. The sun has toasted and browned my skin. But wait, it's not entirely my fault. My brothers were angry with me." About what? We don't know. "They made me keep the vineyards, which I have done. But my own vineyard, my own body, my own looks, I have not been able to keep." That's how I take it anyway. And I will tell you, with the dozens of interpretations of Song of Solomon, my interpretation is as good as any of them. So just take it as you wish. Now, here's how I put the puzzle together. The king shows up one day. He would wander the land with his generals and his attendants and all the pomp. And he shows up one day to just take a look at or check out his vineyard. And he sees this lovely, quote unquote, this lovely young woman. And he is, if you take the phrase out of the movie Pride and Prejudice or out of the book, he is bewitched body and soul. And he falls in love with her and he aims to take her as his wife. So that, as I see it, is kind of the background. That's who she is. That's where she's from. You got the king. You got this poor farm girl. But she is absolutely gorgeous. And she bewitches him body and soul. And he wants her as his wife. Now, I want to give you, as briefly and quickly as I can, five pictures of grace and graciousness in their relationship. Okay? Now, the first picture is what I call the grace of affirmation. Can you read this one? They're walking along. Look at that. Is there anything more beautiful than a baby? As a matter of fact, he says, "Yes, you, me." Sure, babies are beautiful, but they come by that beauty naturally. Beautiful old people are works of art. The first picture is what we call the grace of affirmation. They are words and actions that encourage, that lift up, that take the time to express appreciation. In Song of Solomon chapter 2, verse 1, she says, "I am the rose of Sharon and the lily of the fields." You think, well, so what? Well, that means something. Rose is used one time and is used, translated as a common meadow flower, not as a rose as we think of as a rose. The lily, too, is just another common meadow flower. In other words, there's millions of them. And she's just saying, "I'm just a common nothing, just a common flower in the field." And this is all speaking of her. What would you say? I would say there's some humility. There's some self-doubt. I'm just really nothing special. But take note of Solomon's graciousness, of his kindness and his affirmation. In verse 2, he says, "Okay, you say you're a lily, but I say you're a lily among thorns. To me, all other women are but a briar patch." But he says more. Look at Song of Solomon 1 verse 9. "I have compared you," he says, "my love, to my filly among Pharaoh's chariots." Now, it would not be a gracious move if I told my wife that she reminds me of one of my horses. And this is not what Solomon is saying. He is saying she is one in a million. In 1 Kings chapter 10, verse 26, we're told that Solomon had a stable. Get this. This is why you have to know the broader context. He had a stable of something like 12,000 horses and 1,400 chariots. Well, who do you think owned the strongest and the most beautiful horse in all the kingdom? Solomon did. His horse alone was the best and most beautiful and most powerful of them all. One in a million. So what a generous, gracious, spirited, sensitive man this is. No matter how she tries to belittle herself, no matter how she tries to put herself down, no matter how low or common her opinion of herself may be, no matter how insecure or how much self-doubt she carries, no matter how she might compare herself to the culture of the day and all the beautiful ladies of the court, he turns everything around and affirms her. And that is something significantly special in the heart of a woman or of a man. I play pickleball. I'm addicted to golf and pickleball and other sports. And I play pickleball a lot. And I play with a lot of different guys, Christians and non-Christians. And I play with one guy who happens to be just a wonderful Christian man. And he came up to me one morning and he said, "Steve," he said, "when we're done playing this morning, I need to talk to you. I need to tell you something." Now, I can tell you the first thing I thought when he said that is, I'm in trouble. I've done something wrong. That's how I've lived all my life. When someone needs to talk to me, I've usually made a mistake and I'm in trouble. And he finally afterwards, he said, "Okay, I need to tell you something." And I went, "Okay, what is it?" And I'd been worried all morning, you know, that how have I offended him or whatever. And he said, "I'm staggered by something about you." And I went, "Okay, what's that, Reuben?" He said, "You always compliment Donna. Always. You never say anything about her unless it's something kind or complimentary or nice or uplifting behind her back." And I said, "Well, yeah." "You never speak negative about her. Ever. It's like nothing is more important to you than loving her, whether she's near or afar." And I said, "Well, that's true. That's how I feel. That's how I want to live. That's how I want to treat her." He goes, "Well, I want to tell you why that means so much to me." He said, "Because I was raised in a macho society." He's Italian. He was raised in Argentina. And he said, you didn't never talk about your wife or your girlfriend like this. No, you were macho. You didn't use such words about her." He said, "But you just say it as if it's just the natural thing to do. You love her and she means everything to you." And he said, "I went home last week after listening to you at one small point. You just said a few words." He said, "I couldn't get it off my mind all weekend long." I said, "I'm glad." He said, "I just want to thank you." And he said, "I've never learned what it's been like to serve humbly with love my wife." And so the grace of affirmation, of taking the culture and turning it upside down, or your wife or your husband's lower opinion about themselves than they should have, and somehow taking it to a place where it touches their heart and affirming them as someone extremely special to you, as if it doesn't matter what anybody else says or thinks. "You are a lily among thorns to me." That's grace right there. And we don't see enough of that today, in my opinion. Now, the second picture of grace. Oh, this one I love. The grace of physical and tender touch. I love this one. "Remember when you used to hold my hand like this? Then you used to lean over and give me a peck on the cheek." Peck. "And then you'd nibble on the back of my neck." "Where are you going?" "To get my teeth." Oh, my goodness. I love that one. Now, I'm not at that place where I need my teeth from a jar yet, but that's where we're all maybe headed. Look at Song of Solomon 2:4-6. "The grace of physical and tender touch. He brought me to the banqueting house, and his banner over me was love. Sustain me with cakes of raisins. Refresh me with apples, for I am lovesick. His left hand is under my head, and his right hand embraces me." Solomon has brought his love out into public, into the palace, and I can only imagine his excitement of presenting her, of showing her off to everyone. Take note of something wonderful in these three verses. It's one thing to say to her behind closed doors, you're one in a million. It's another thing to tell her to her face that she is special, but it's another thing to show it out in public. There is affirmation here. His banner over me is love. In other words, like a banner flag carried into battle for all the warriors to see, so too was Solomon's love for her at his dinner party. His love affirmed in front of all was a flag run up high on the pole. This man loves this woman. His love affirmed was like a skywriter's message in the cloud. Everything he did communicated love. Everything he said communicated love. He did not smother her. Surely he gave her room to breathe, but he was uninhibited in showing everyone just how much he loved her and how special she was to him. But he did something else. And this is the point of this second grace. He touched her tenderly in front of everyone. I am sick with love, she said, but he strengthens my heart. His left hand is under my head. His right hand embraces me. How loving is an embrace, a touch at the right moment? How much power does a tender touch have to impact a heart? How much grace does it show? The banquet hall is packed. Think about it. It's packed with intimidating cosmopolitan beauties from the court. The table is surrounded and protected by Solomon's great warriors. Israel's most powerful names sit in submission to Solomon the king. And there is this farm girl, for goodness sake, this brown-skinned, strange-looking farm girl, for goodness sake. And he puts his arm around her and he touches her to show his affection, the grace of tender touch. I want to tell you something my wife doesn't know about her. I've never told her. And I hope she never sees this video. When I touch my wife, we'll be driving along and I'll just reach over and I'll put my hand on her leg or her knee. We've been married coming up on 49 years, and every single time I do that, you know what she does? She grabs my hand. She takes it very gently in her two hands and she just holds it. And she just never lets go. I can't tell you what that little moment means every time it happens. Just that touch of graciousness between the two of us. I touch her, she grabs my hand and holds it. A long, long time ago, our marriage went through, and when you've been married 49 years, maybe you've just ridden this great tsunami wave of happiness and joy. But we've been through our deep, dark valleys in 49 years. We've been through some scary times. And we went through a deep, dark time, and it seemed like black clouds hovered and covered us, and we felt them, and we suffered under them. But I will never forget when I talked yesterday about being born again twice, once with Christ and once by her mercy. This was another one. I will never forget the morning when those black clouds just swirled around us. That one of the most special day of our years together, she came up to me without warning. She put her arms around me and she said, at least, no matter what, we have each other. And she just held on to me. We have each other. And she held on. I'll never forget it. The grace of physical tender touch. Third picture. What I call, here we go, the grace of quality time alone together. We don't spend enough time together. What are you talking about? We're together 24 hours a day. That's quantity time, she says. I'm talking about quality time. Don't you know what quality time is? Here we go, quality fabrics. Oh, crud, it's coming back to me now. Donna used to drag me to, what were those fabric stores all the time? I always defined hell as you go to a fabric store and have to wander the aisles for all eternity. The third picture, Cloth World, that's where it was. Cloth World is hell on earth. The third picture is what I call the grace, the gift of carving out quality alone time together. The king was a busy man. All you got to do is read 1 Kings 1 through 11. Building the temple, the wall, hosting kings, the queen of Sheba, he carried the weight of the nation on his shoulders. Of all men who have ever lived, he could complain, I have no time for you. I have no time at all to do anything but work. So many people need me, I cannot let them down. And this is why in chapter 2, verses 10 through 13, it's one of my favorites. She is speaking, and she said, my beloved spoke and said to me, rise up, my love, my fair one, and come away. Winter is past, the rain is over and gone, the flowers appear on the earth, the time of singing has come, and the voice of the turtle dove is heard in our land. The fig tree puts forth her fig trees, and the vines with tender grapes give a good smell. Rise up, my fair one, my love, and come away. I love this. Here is the world's richest man. He could have planned a complex, expensive trip away somewhere exotic. But he said, no, I just want to go and be with you alone in the country. Solomon would shut down work. He would close down his computer for a day, a weekend, a week to focus on her, on their relationship. He initiated the time alone. He searched for a place to be together. He had every material blessing, but it was intimacy alone together that he sought. That's beautiful. Two people in love enjoy doing simple things together and enjoy simple things about each other. In verse 14, I love it when he says, just let me see your face. Just let me hear your voice. Maybe I overdo it. I know I'm a bit intense about some things, but this is a big deal to me, and I am ruthless, ruthless about time alone with my wife. 7 mornings a week, we begin in this little sunroom with a cup of coffee, and most evenings we spend it alone in the little room talking, alone. Most weekends, I say, look, I'll do anything you want Monday through Thursday night with friends, but I want to have the weekends alone with you as much as possible. 3 weeks ago, we returned from a 5-week car trip, 7,700 miles across the United States to do nothing but see America. Alone. This coming fall, we're taking a 4-week car trip to New England, 2 weeks in Camden, Maine. We'll be fly fishing. We'll be playing pickleball. Next year's our 50th anniversary. I've got a plan. We're going to go to Europe. We're going to hike the whole country of Liechtenstein in 4 days. Then we're going to go to the Lake District in Italy. In 2014, we left New Zealand on November the 4th with backpacks on our back, and we traveled 1 year before we landed in Coeur d'Alene after 41 countries traveling around the world together. From New Zealand to get to Spokane, Washington. A time alone to sit and talk and be affectionate and listen and ask questions. How are we doing? How have I treated you today? How are we doing this week? What are things like? How are you feeling right now? Time alone together. I could talk on and on. Fourth picture, the grace of serving one another. I love this. In the ultimate act of sacrificial love, a man plugs in his wife's phone instead of his. Okay, you don't get that. Okay, we'll go to the next one. Here's this one. I came across an inspiring quote this morning. Oh? If today you are a little better than yesterday, then that's enough, David Bednar said. And this morning I picked up a Cheerio off the floor without being asked. So, well, yesterday I would have just left it there. There's the grace, the gift of serving each other, okay? Now, normally when we think of serving, we think of things like make them breakfast or dinner or take out the trash or vacuum the house or surprise, do this or that, and that's fine. But there is a graciousness, a humble gifting in a marriage that takes the lead in rebuilding what may be breaking or broken in the marriage. One of the many things I love and appreciate about my wife is when our marriage takes any kind of downward turn, she is on it in a flash. When our marriage is in a sad or unpleasant place, she tightens her belt, goes to work, and serves our marriage. There is humility on her part. There is an intensity, a gifting of our marriage with her focus to set things right again and to serve me and her and the relationship. And anyway, this is what you see in Song of Solomon. I'm trying to cover this. Catch the foxes for us, the little foxes that are ruining our vineyards. Now, what's going on there is they are struggling in the relationship and the foxes are destroying the vineyard, which is the marriage. So the little problems that are going on. And so we need to catch those things. We need to find the things that are hurting our relationship and get after those as quickly as possible. Now, I think we are reading poetry here, not something literal, of course. The vineyard represents the relationship, and the foxes, even the little foxes, are things that destroy it. I love what Craig Glickman wrote in his book. Foxes represent as many obstacles or temptations that have plagued lovers throughout the centuries. Perhaps it is the fox of mistrust which breaks the bond of love, or it may be the fox of selfishness and pride which refuses to let one acknowledge his fault to another, or it may be an unforgiving spirit which will not accept the apology of the other. These foxes have been ruining vineyards for years, and the end of their work is not in sight. There are foxes in your relationship. They're destroying your vineyard. You got to go after them, and you have to catch them, and you have to catch them early on. Now, I want to take note of a couple of things. Serving with grace means first affirming our love. My love is mine, and I am his. That's always affirmed. I am yours, you are mine. We love each other. Second, the foxes, even the little ones, can do their damage. No fox is to be overlooked or ignored in a relationship. Spot them, catch them, and kill them. Whether it's weak communication or impatience or selfishness or defensiveness or lack of mutual submissiveness and loving leadership, these kinds of things. Many things feed the little foxes and help them grow into big ones. Like, I don't have the problem. You have the problem. You're the problem. I don't want to deal with the fox. It's too much trouble. It's too much pain. And so, you know, these things, whatever issues you have in your vineyard, you and I need to catch those foxes and kill them as quickly as possible. Cliff Barrow said something really neat. Relationships are held together by 12 words. I am wrong. I am sorry. Please forgive me. I love you. The first to apologize is the bravest. The first to forgive is the strongest. The first to forget is the happiest. I have that posted right next to my desk. I look at it every day. Finally, fifth picture. The grace of gifts. I'm sorry about the faux pas on that card I gave you. It was just an honest spelling error. I really didn't mean to call you my sweaty pie. Here's a new card to say how sorry I am. And she reads, please forgive me, angle face. No, it's supposed to say angel face. There's the grace of gifts, the graciousness of gift giving, the graciousness of the best gifts that one can give. When we think of gifts, we think of jewelry, we think of a book, a set of golf clubs, perfume, and all of that. But let me give you one other, and I'll finish with this. And I think it's worth more than all. And that is the graciousness, the thoughtfulness of the gift of watching over and protecting one another. They're about to get married, and she's reflecting, who is this coming out of the wilderness like pillars of smoke perfumed? And it goes on, behold, it's Solomon's couch, a portable enclosed traveling chair, with 60 valiant men around it. They all hold swords. They're expert in war. Every man his sword on his thigh because of the fear in the night that is guarding against the terrors of the night. Of the wood of Lebanon. And it goes on and on. And it says, its interior is paved with love. Now, what enormous gifts these all were to this maiden's heart. What gigantic gifts these all were going into their marriage. The gift of knowing that this day was a day of gladness for the king. The gift of seeing the king build a special transport for that special day. And the gift of resting with her husband in an environment paved with love. The gift of being the reason the king gladly gave his very best to her. And the gift of the promise, I will protect you against all fears. I'm going to take care of you. For me, this plays out, I can tell you, giving my wife the best I can, paving everything I give her with love and affection and words that touch her heart, telling her often how glad I am that she is my wife, and protecting her with hard work, life insurance, wise money management, a financial plan for the future, and defending and sheltering her from harm and disrespect and abuse. That is the picture we're seeing that Solomon brings into this marriage. Those are powerful things. Now, I'll finish with this. I know I go a little far, but and I can't say I'm proud of what I did. But this protection of someone you love. She and I were on a train from Madrid to Lisbon a few years ago. And I was sitting here and she was sitting beside me and the other two chairs were facing us. And across from us were two men. And this man came on the train drunk. And the people in the train, working the train, continued to give him more alcohol. So he continued to get drunker and drunker. And I'm watching this and I'm thinking, okay, that's not my problem. But it became my problem. Because what happened was my wife, my precious wife, tried to lean over. She put her eye mask on and she tried to lean over in the corner and go to sleep. What this man did is he began to stick his foot out and try to touch her with his foot, his shoe off, every chance he got. And I'm watching this out of the corner of my eye. Now, she doesn't know what's happening. She thinks he's just accidentally moving. She keeps crunching up to her. She's a ball about as tight as a tennis ball. She can't even move. She's trying to stay out of the way of this guy. And I finally look at him and I go, no, you need to stop doing that. Well, he threw out his chest like, don't fool with me. So I watched this little, I watched him get up. I watched him stagger down the aisle. I watched him come back and bump into people. This was the middle of the night. The train was dark. People were trying to sleep. He sat back down. He began to do it some more to my wife. Well, here's what I did. That just crosses a line. Okay, I'm sorry. I grabbed him by the collar. And I dragged him down the aisle and I took him through one car and the next car and the next car to the very back to where all the employees were sitting in the middle of the night playing cards and drinking themselves. And I said, do any of you speak English? And they all had eyes this big. And one guy said, yeah. And I said, this man is drunk. He is touching my wife. And if he touches her one more time, I'm going to throw him off this train. Well, their eyes got this big. And I said, I'm serious. And I said, here he is, and I'm going to go back. Well, an hour later, here comes one of the guys, and they gather up his stuff. An hour later, the train stops. The police come on board and arrest this guy and take him off the train. Now, I'm not saying I did the right thing. Would I have thrown him off the train? No, because I don't want to go to jail for murder. Okay? But you know what? You don't fool with someone's wife, okay? You don't fool with my wife. And there's a protection thing there. There's a love thing that lets the wife. She never knew any of this happened. She woke up later and went, how'd your night go? I said, I'm doing great. Finally got to sleep. And she goes, what happened to that guy across from me? And I said, I don't know. You know? Those are at least five ways grace can be shown in a marriage. And by the way, there was a book years ago called The Five Love Languages. Every one of his five languages are the five I just gave you from the Song of Solomon. It's nothing new. They've all been there. So I hope this helps a little bit, okay? Thanks for coming, and God bless you and your marriage.